welcome back. I'm going to be introducing our next panel. It's a real pleasure to introduce two advocates who I admire so greatly for how they tirelessly agitate in the public sphere, not afraid to speak their mind to expose the many wrongdoings of governments and corporations so that others can hopefully be a little bit more free to speak absent of government surveillance and repression. I'm going to introduce the two speakers, and it's quite nice because their talks are very complementary. Chris Egoyan will be talking about surveillance, and Jillian York will be talking a little bit about activism around the leaks that WikiLeaks provided to the world. So Jillian York is EFF's, the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Director for International Freedom of Expression. She specializes in free speech issues in the Arab world and the privatization of censorship, and is also particularly interested in surveillance technology, expert controls, global online activism, distributed denial of service campaigns, and international policy. Prior to joining the EFF, Jillian York spent 3 years at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, where she managed the Open Net Initiative. She holds a BA in sociology from Binghamton University, where I like this little part of her bio, where surprisingly, a large number of individuals in her field, she also studied theater. Chris Egoyan is the principal technologist and a senior policy analyst with the American Civil Liberties Union, and he works for the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. He completed his PhD at Indiana University in 2012, which focused on the role that third-party service providers play in facilitating law enforcement surveillance of their customers. Between 2009 and 2010, he was the first ever in-house technologist at the Federal Trade Commission Division of Privacy and Identity Protection. So let me now introduce the title of Jillian's talk. She'll be talking about, it's called From Tunis Leaks to Bassem Youssef, Revolutionary Media in the Arab World. And Chris Egoyan will be talking about surveillance, and his title is called Can You Hear Me Now?
Thank you. I'm just going to do this real quick. Sorry. I apologize for not being here. Thank you. Excellent. Hi. Thank you for having me here. So just before the WikiLeaks Cablegate release in 2010, Al Jazeera released the Palestine Papers, which were a collection of about 1,600 documents from internal negotiations over the years in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This was the first major Arab whistleblowing leak that had happened in Arab media since the Iran-Contra affair, really. And so Al Jazeera was undoubtedly inspired by WikiLeaks. You'd seen Collateral Murder just a few months before that, and there had been a number of other leaks that came out earlier than that around blacklists of internet censorship in other countries, which had indeed had an impact in the region. At the same time, the Palestine Papers were definitely overshadowed by Cablegate, which happened just a couple months later, where that had its strongest impact in the region, Tunisia, where you've seen people say, Sami Ben Gharbia, for example, an activist, had said that the cables tipped the balance in Tunisia around public opinion. A lot of the cables that had come out around that region had indeed shown that the U.S. was kind of talking out one side about human rights and then doing something else on the other. And so a lot of those releases indeed kind of inspired some of the activism that occurred in Tunisia in late 2010. They were by no means the sort of revolutionary spark, but they did have an impact. And the reason for that largely was that WikiLeaks chose, interestingly enough, to partner with organizations in the region. So one of the first was TuniLeaks in Tunisia. This was brought forth by a group called Noat, whose founders had primarily been exiled in Europe, but who had over the years created one of the most interesting revolutionary media organizations in the region, publishing all sorts of interesting details about corruption in Tunisia. One of my favorite examples from, I think, 2006 is this case where there had been some photographs online of the presidential plane showing up in different parts of the world, and no one could quite figure out why it was in Paris at a given time or why it was somewhere else. And as it turned out, you can go online, you can kind of look at these photos and begin to match locations and dates. And what they did was they took that and mapped it to the times when the president was actually in the country and the plane was in other countries. And as it turned out, this was primarily the first lady using it for shopping excursions. And so some of these interesting details that Nawat had released over the years kind of put them forward as the real kind of doer in that country. And so when TuniLeaks came out, when they came forward, they actually translated a lot of those cables, making them accessible to people who might otherwise not read English. And so they were in French, and some of them were in Arabic. And this ended up spreading to Morocco as well. So someone in Morocco actually took the Moroccan cables and translated them and launched a site called MoroLeaks. And so you had TuniLeaks, MoroLeaks, and that inspired other partnerships as well. So later on, WikiLeaks actually released some of the cables to Al-Akhbar, a newspaper in Lebanon, and there were other cases too. And so while this wasn't the revolutionary spark, as I said, some have stated that this is the mechanism that allowed people to overcome the concept of sort of pluralistic ignorance, the idea that everyone knows, everyone has this feeling, everyone feels a certain way about the government but doesn't talk about it. And so in Tunisia, where you had rampant mass surveillance over the years, a lot of it targeted but a lot of data being collected, and I'll get back to that in just a minute, you had an absolute culture of fear where people were not able to discuss these things except in very quiet places. You know, I now in the US, it's become a little bit more common for people to take their batteries out of their phones, but when I first started working with Tunisian activists in about 2008, that was absolutely de rigueur for them. And so there was this idea that, yes, they can listen in on our phones, yes, they're listening in on my, you know, on my landline, on my mobile phone, and watching all of my electronic communications. And so these things were just not discussed in the public sphere. And so that's where the leaks really had an impact. It was the idea that once this is all out there, once this is public and everyone knows that it's happening, then it becomes freer than to discuss it. So at the same time, the reaction to WikiLeaks in the region was primarily one of, let's shut this thing down. And so you saw governments trying to block the websites, block websites that were hosting or mirroring the cables. But at the same time, Doha Debates, which is a forum in Qatar, did a poll that found that 60% of its respondents said that the world is better off with WikiLeaks, and 75% of the respondents said that they wanted more leaks about the Arab world. So I'm going to come back a little bit to some of the other things that I mentioned about surveillance, which is that in Tunisia, you had a pretty strong censorship regime. Surveillance wasn't really talked about, but Tunisia's censorship was, I wouldn't say on par with China's, but it was pretty extreme at the time. And while in the US, a lot of the activism and a lot of the funding, particularly from the State Department, has been around trying to overcome censorship in China and Iran primarily, Tunisia was getting up there over the years. They began to block things like Facebook, only for a couple weeks. It was unblocked eventually, but then they went after YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, and all of these other video sharing sites, which is really interesting when you think about some of the videos that came later, both in Tunisia and elsewhere in the region. And so while this extreme censorship was happening, it turned out that the mechanisms, the tools that were used to block websites came from the US. And in fact, the Tunisian government had offered these companies, or sorry, the companies had offered the Tunisian government a discount in exchange for bug testing. And so you had the Tunisian government completely working with American companies to censor the internet and to surveil it as well, although that didn't come out until much later. So after what we saw in 2011, where the uprisings and revolution started, you began to see a much stronger push for transparency. And so in Tunisia in particular, in January 2012, there was a vote for a bill around transparency and open government. And the Constituent Assembly voted 149-3 in favor of this. Article 62 of this is particularly interesting. It says, public information is the rule, secrecy is the exception. Kind of a surprise, kind of a real 180 from a year before that. And so there's now been created a much stronger culture around this kind of media. Nawat has continued on. Most of its founders have gone back to Tunisia now that they're welcome there, and have continued to work on producing whistleblowing mechanisms. They've actually put out quite a few leaks around IMF meddling in the country, and a few other things. It's really interesting if you check out their site, but I'm not going to focus too much on that. I'm going to move to Morocco for just a moment, where I used to live, and where when I was there, one of the most fascinating blogs that I came across was about this person, this unknown person called the Targhis Sniper. And this was in 2007, 2008. And what the sniper, not a real sniper, of course, did was sit up in the hills in a particularly trafficked area in the south of Morocco and photograph police corruption. So police would pull over cars that were not doing anything wrong and bribe, basically. And this Targhis Sniper captured a number of these and put them up on YouTube. And the government at first didn't really know how to react to this, and then eventually took that mechanism and used it for themselves. And so they began to actually set up cameras and catch police in the act in the same way. So it was a really interesting case of how an individual trying to turn corruption on its head could actually inspire a government to follow suit. It's not to say that corruption is particularly solved yet, but what's interesting about that is that while Morocco kind of escaped a lot of, or avoided a lot of the negative things that have happened since 2011 in the region, there have been a number of developments around media. And so you've seen, the February 20th movement in Morocco, one of the major news sites that came out of that was called Memfakinch. And they were, as it turns out, involved in the WikiLeaks cables as well. And so a lot of this, the leaking, inspired media development. One interesting thing, though, that happened earlier this year there, was Danielgate. I don't know if you've heard of this, but there was a Spanish pedophile that was given a royal pardon and allowed to go back to his country. And Moroccans were not very happy about this, and it became one of the biggest campaigns on social media in the country in years. They called it Danielgate, after the name of the person, and the hashtag was trending and all of that, which may or may not matter. But ultimately, The most interesting effect of this was that one of the journalists who had been pushing so hard on this particular case and had been writing about it on a particularly revolutionary website itself was arrested and charged with terrorism. Now, not for his agitation against that particular incident, but for linking to an article in a Spanish newspaper that in turn linked to a video that was posted by Al-Qaeda. And so he's been charged under terrorism statutes in the country, charged with the aiding and abetting, and basically what would probably port to material support in the U.S., and right now is released on bail but faces significant prison time for this particular act of agitation. So that's not one of the happier stories. But I'll move on to Jordan for a moment, where transparency has not been the norm, and where in the past couple of years we've seen attempts to create a press and publications law that would require media organizations to register for a license, and if they did not do that, get censored. And so nobody actually believed that this was going to happen, and a lot of the media organizations refused on principle to register for licenses. And then we're surprised in June of this year when the government in turn censored more than 500 websites. Many of these continue to refuse to apply for licenses, but also remain censored, which is kind of interesting. I can't imagine that happening a few years ago. But at the same time, you've seen some of these organizations continue to publish on alternative websites. So they'll publish on Facebook instead of publishing on their own site because they know that the government will never go so far as to block it, which is basically this method of finding other channels, mirroring and mirroring and mirroring until the government can't go further with their censorship. And there have been other interesting media developments as well throughout the region. You've seen in Egypt, the development, of course, I mentioned in the title of the talk, so I can't pass this one over, Egypt's John Stewart, Bassem Youssef, who has also faced considerable trouble but continues to produce his program. Going back to surveillance for just a minute, though, because I want to link this back to what Chris is going to say. A lot of the leaks, a lot of the things that we've found out over the past couple of years tie very closely to what's happening in the U.S., and I feel like that's a point that I can't miss. So I'll just move over to that for a moment. In 2011 in Egypt, a number of activists raided the State Security Office, and one of the things that they found was records of their own surveillance. Now, what's interesting about this is that quite a few of the people that I've spoken to who found records on themselves never actually faced arrest and were never actually questioned, but and yet there were all of these records, and so it was clear that Egypt was conducting mass surveillance in the country, and largely surveillance for surveillance sake. Now, what's interesting about that and how I think it ties so closely to the U.S. is that they were using one of the same tools by one of the same companies, which was NARIS, which is owned by Boeing. The NARIS STA-6400 is the same device that was found in the AT&T Center in San Francisco when in their collusion with the NSA. And it is, and I quote, used for its ability to sift through large data sets looking for pre-programmed targets. That's absolutely what was being used in Egypt. And we've also seen a lot of American companies perfectly willing to sell to other repressive regimes. Now, in some cases, this gets them in trouble. For example, in the case of Blue Coat, which sold its own technology to Syria, as well as Iran and Sudan, all three of which are under sanctions by the U.S., which makes it illegal for them to do so. But at the same time, they've also sold to Venezuela, China, Singapore, Egypt, all countries that may very well be repressive in their surveillance and other practices, but not illegal to sell to them. And outside of the region, Pakistan, we saw in 2012 the Pakistani government issue an RFP asking for companies, Western companies largely, to submit for a system that would allow them to conduct deep packet inspection. A couple of American companies put in bids, and I believe the winner was actually a Canadian company in the end. And so I think that really what I want to get to is that a lot of the discussions about surveillance have centered on privacy, and I don't think that that's wrong, but I also think that when we're talking about this, we need to think of the impact of surveillance on freedom of expression. There was a great talk last year by Rebecca McKinnon, whose work some of you may know. She spoke about Tunisia again in 2005 when they had hosted the World Summit on Information Society, the WSIS, which was really one of the triggering events for awareness around internet censorship. At that meeting, she had sat in on a panel where someone from Zimbabwe had actually been questioned by someone in the audience saying, yeah, but really, censorship is not as big of a deal as, say, poverty or food security. And this person responded and said, okay, but without freedom of speech, I can't talk about who's stealing my food. I think that that's exactly where we stand. The freedom to discuss the things that we need to happen in our countries, the ability to talk about repression, the ability to talk about any of these issues cannot happen when we fear surveillance. There was a really interesting article, I'm just going to bring this back to the U.S. and then I'll stop. There was a really interesting article a couple of days ago. The New York Times covered a survey that was conducted by PEN, the writers' organization that seeks to protect writers, protect freedom of expression, and found that many of its American writers, the respondents to the survey, felt that this was the worst time in history in the U.S. for freedom of expression and privacy, and also felt that they had a newfound sense of fear in their writing, that they were beginning to self-censor. So when you see that American writers are beginning to self-censor in the same way that Tunisian writers self-censored, that Egyptian writers self-censored, I think that's when we really have to begin to worry. continue to worry. I'm sure that you are all thinking about this as well. So I'll close there and hand it over to Chris. Thank you.